Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for January 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am joined once again by the one and only Mr. Tim Nelson.
Hey, everybody.
Tim, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, John. Good to be here.
Thank you. Now, since the last time we talked, we now live in a world where every single person on the planet has seen The Force Awakens.
That's true.
Including us.
Twice.
Give me a 10-second review.
Of The Force Awakens?
Yes.
It is as it was. That's what they said about the Pope said about The Passion of the Christ. That's what I say about The Force Awakens. It is as it was.
All right. I think mine would be step in the right direction, better than the prequels, thank you, but slightly overrated. Would you agree with that a little bit? Like, you're starting to hear Best of the Seven talk. I don't know if I can go there.
Yeah, it's like some kind of corporate delusion that we're sharing. I think it was a lot of fun. What a great thing to be released at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think everyone agrees it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it does draw heavily on our fandom and our need for comfort almost in the old ones.
Exactly. Good. Now, and I know the last time we talked too, we had mentioned possibly seeing The Revenant together, but something came up since then that we just flat out couldn't miss. So director Quentin Tarantino has a new movie out, which in and of itself is something to stop and pay attention about. But the way that he released it and shot it is what really caught our attention. So Tarantino shot this new movie, which is The Hateful Eight, in 70mm. And a select group of theaters around the country actually are playing the film right now in that format. Only 100 theaters. And our local theater had it as this special, like, roadshow presentation, like they used to do back in the day.
It's a technical term, right? I didn't even know what it was.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we went because we couldn't miss it, and apparently the Weinstein Company actually handpicked the theater, so we were pretty privileged to be able to go to one that did that. Apparently, according to an interview I heard from Tarantino, only like 12 or 13 theaters around the country were even equipped to do this before this movie came out, and so they went all out. They busting down walls, renovating the theaters, doing what they had to do to get that projector in there and make this possible. So we went and saw The Hateful Eight in 70mm, and that is what we are going to be talking about today, along with taking a little look at the whole Quentin Tarantino canon and what makes Tarantino Tarantino. So that's on the docket for today. So let's start off by talking about this whole term 70mm. I don't think everyone is familiar with it. I know I wasn't before I started doing research when I heard about this. So, Tim, maybe you could just start off by, what do you know about 70mm? What does that mean?
I don't know a ton about 70mm.
Okay.
But I can give you what I know.
Okay.
70mm is a different format. Most films are shot in 35mm, 24 frames per second. 70mm, there's different speeds for 70mm as far as how many frames per second, but it's just bigger. I mean, that's the reality. Shot with different cameras, different lenses. It's fraught with a bunch of different problems. It has a different aspect ratio, so it's more letterbox than what you're used to being letterbox.
Okay.
So that's what it is. It was used in the, I guess, developed in the 50s and used in the 50s and 60s. And really was, if you're making an epic and you've got a huge budget and you want to show scenery, like Lawrence of Arabia was in 70mm, Ben-Hur is in 70mm.
So it's a wider format is what you're saying, like landscape type shots, right?
Yeah, it's like you want to feel like you're in the desert with Lawrence of Arabia.
Right.
You shoot in that format. It was more expensive. You have to have a different kind of projector. Mm. It gets really complicated. And one of the things it does is actually lets more light onto the screen if it's done properly.
Oh.
So actually brighter films. Which is kind of, that's an advantage to people who love film.
Absolutely.
But yeah, with 70mm, I mean, you have to change the aspect ratios. And so it's really going, he's digging deep. He's going very far back to do that.
Yep.
And one more thing, sorry.
Yeah, no.
It actually had six, on 70mm strip, you'd have the images, right?
Right.
But you also have six magnetic strips on there. And those magnetic strips were, each one was a track for sound. So you could have six tracks of sound. at those theaters, and like you've probably heard like Dolby 5.1 or whatever.
Yeah.
So your real true, like you could, the first real sound innovations you see in 70 millimeter with six tracks. Obviously now things are totally different with the right. digital sound, but at the time that was pretty revolutionary.
How many tracks did 35 run on typically?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not, like I said, I'm not, the technical aspects aren't
right.
I'm not familiar with. In fact, I didn't even know this when we went in. You brought it up, and then I was mm-hmm. like, I got to find out what this means.
You have to. And what's also special is that Tarantino went for kind of an experience with this, right? So not only is it shot in 70, but he gives you things in that format that he doesn't give you in the theatrical cut. So you have this musical prologue, which was kind of cool, right? I remember walking mm-hmm. in the theater with you, and we were like, you have kind of a static shot that sets the mood for the film, and you have that amazing score already kicking in right before the film starts.
It's almost like attending a play.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It, which is great. And no trailers or commercials. Can I get an amen for that?
Amen. I'm raising my hand. You can't see it. I got Pentecostal there. Oh. It was weird. I mean, it was we are so used to having to buying something or having like a soda jump around to become anthropomorphic in the beginning of a film that when there was nothing but a still shot of like a stagecoach and some mountains and then a beautiful score in the background, mm-hmm. people didn't know what to do, but it was like kind of strangely comforting.
Absolutely. And then even an intermission, which I'm a huge fan of, a chance to like get out there and talk about the movie a little bit, talk about the first half, get revved up for the second, get a refill, you know, that was great. And it's a little bit longer too than the theatrical cut by about 20 minutes ish, something like that. So it was kind of an experience, which I thought was sweet.
And he divides it in like acts, basically. There's five acts,
yep.
right?
Yep, he does.
So to have that intermission is great. And where the intermission occurred was like perfect because it was a very shocking point in the film.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He said that in his interview. He was like, he knew exactly where to put the intermission because that speech called curtains, he said. So,
can't you, I mean, when we're in the theater,
yeah.
you walk out and people are like wide-eyed and we're like, did we just watch that? And you right. still have a second right. half of the movie to watch.
It's such, because it's such a turning point, not only yeah. for the film, but for that character too.
Yes.
Yeah. So, all things considered, then, I take it you enjoyed the 70 millimeter experience.
Yeah, I know. I do like it. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. I know you might call them antiquarians or whatever, but you've got like Paul Thomas Anderson is mm-hmm. a big, you were telling me about.
He did The Master in 70, and yeah, so that was kind of the first step of this. And Christopher Nolan, his next movie's in 70 as well, so they're kind of paving the way for the future. Tarantino, one of his selling points was Christopher Nolan's right behind us, so this is going to keep paying off.
So that it actually, there are, I mean, you know, like just looking at the Tarantino films, you know you're going to make money just having his name on a film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they're making 70 millimeters. Not it's a novelty, but it's really a higher quality. It's a higher quality experience.
It feels like it.
And so, I mean, I think it is good to have these powerful writer directors behind yeah. these.
Oh, and you get a playbook. Remember the playbook we got?
Yeah, yeah, that's
which
right.
which we boldly claim will be worth tons of money someday.
I think it's limited probably edition. Worth money now. Yeah,
it could be. I mean,
I got a poster of Samuel L. Jackson for my room.
Yes,
I don't know if my wife's gonna let me put it in my room.
Probably iffy. So okay, now I want to get to the heart of Tarantino. So Tim, let me ask you a question. What makes a Quentin Tarantino movie a Quentin Tarantino movie? What are the elements that make him unique? Why are we talking about him for this length of time here? What makes him a good director?
So I don't want to like claim I know everything about Tarantino. I know a few things. I always think of him a little bit kind of like if you've ever read like T.S. Eliot, where you have to know a whole bunch of authors before you can read T.S. Eliot in order to begin to kind of almost decode T.S. Eliot. And I see Tarantino films are similar because they reference so many other prior works that it,
some would say he rips off other works.
You could call it ripping off. You know, homage. We use that term a lot. But it does seem like you have to know these other films to mm-hmm. a certain degree to kind of enter into that experience. So, I think that's one element.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's other moments. I think extreme violence.
Yes. There's no question. These are extreme movies. I mean, I think it's fair to say. Tarantino has very polarizing reactions to his films, and I don't think, you know, if, like, for instance, if you go out to someone and you say, what do you think about Quentin Tarantino? And they're like, yeah, it's a little too much for me. You're not going to be surprised by that, right? Because these are extreme in pretty much every way. And we don't get caught up in content a lot around here because, you know, we think it's distracting focusing on the surface like that. But there's no question that this goes beyond what is normal content in a film.
Yeah, I think it's like, yeah, it is. It's hyper-violence.
Right.
And it becomes his aesthetic. Hmm. So that, like, that's what people go for to a certain degree is the hyper-violence. And it's not even realistic. So, like, there's five times as much blood as in a human body when a head gets cut off in Kill
right.
Bill.
Right.
So that itself is like, it's not realism even. Like, real violence, it's not even real violence. It's some version of it that's, it's actually, and some people would say that's like art. Mm-hmm. And it would be in like the vein of like Kubrick in mm-hmm. like Clockwork Orange. It's like hyper violence as a form of artwork. That's really difficult to swallow, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. And, not a lot of people are going to wade into those waters, and you can't blame him, but that is his style. And it's almost too like, one of his strengths, it's a mixed bag, right? Because you know this going in, that he kind of frames these movies as you never know what to expect. You're always on this wild ride that anything can happen at any given moment.
Yeah.
I think dialogue is a huge thing when you're talking about Tarantino. The way that he writes dialogue is very unique because he has these drawn-out conversations that can sometimes last 20, 25 minutes of just people talking, but you're never bored. I don't know how he does it, but it's just the way, and not even, the things they're talking about aren't even always innately interesting. It's the way they talk about them.
I think there's a little bit of an absurdist there's a juxtaposition between the hyper-violence and this absurd dialogue that's very light. Mm. So, like, when you know, all of us remember the Pulp Fiction scene where Samuel L. Jackson is eating this guy's hamburger and he's about to murder him.
Right, the big kahuna burger.
That's detail. A tasty burger.
Yeah.
And he's, like, licking his lips, and he's, like, and he's philosophical, but he's a hitman. So I think there's kind of absurdity there that makes it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a character who you'd expect to be crass and maybe uneducated or at least a little swarthy, mm-hmm. and they end up having this bizarre, they talk about a hamburger, but they also are into, you know, they're also talking about their
the metric system,
life, the metric system,
yeah,
Royale with cheese,
Royale with cheese. So yeah, I would say feminist characters are a huge staple of his as well. He has very strong female characters, which I think is awesome. I mean, you could argue that some of the strongest female characters in film come from Quentin Tarantino's works. It's I like it.
I know my brother took some classes at like he went to UCSD, and he had a professor that basically argued that Tarantino was the most feminist filmmaker out there right now. At that time. And so that you had these strong female leads. You have men that are afraid of blood all the time, which I think is really interesting. You can get into that.
That's true.
Yeah, he's also got... So I think that you do have the... Like, obviously Kill Bill, mm-hmm. but you see it throughout those films. You see, you know, he's obsessed with Uma Thurman. Because she's like this strong female lead that he envisions as kind of his ultimate protagonist.
But you see it in every one of his movies. There's a very strong, well, except Reservoir Dogs, I guess. I don't know if Reservoir Dogs has a female character, but that would be pretty much the sole exception. But yeah. So Tarantino's made 8 films, okay? And ironically, this 8th film is called The Hateful Eight. I'm sure that some people who hate Tarantino probably would refer to his work as The Hateful Eight, right? So 8 movies, and we know this because he tells us it on every single film. He's keeping count for us. It's always the 8th film by Quentin Tarantino. That's how he designates it on the
it's
credits.
It's helpful to us, yes. Mm-hmm. For those that don't count well, I didn't know that, but he helped me remember.
So when you look at that's 8 films. When you look at that whole canon, Tim, what stands out to you? Do you have a favorite? Do you have one you think is his best film? Maybe that's one and the same. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
So I know just from a visceral, like the one that I have the most emotional attachment to would be Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
Because it came out the year I learned how to drive. And I remember being able to go to that film. We knew the guy that was selling the tickets, so I was like 16, but I could get into the R-rated movie. And I think I went three times.
Wow.
During that, and just kind of was a little obsessed with a bunch of my friends, and that mm-hmm. was my introduction to him. I had no idea Reservoir Dogs existed, so I think I'm mostly emotionally attached to that mm-hmm. one. But I do think probably Inglourious Basterds would be the one that I think is from. Just a story standpoint and just looking how clever he is
mm-hmm.
and appreciating his ability to craft story.
Yeah.
I really think that's probably my favorite film of his.
Okay.
From just more kind of an adult standpoint, not a 16-year-old kid.
Sure. Thank you. I hear you on Pulp Fiction, man. That was my first introduction to him too. And, you know, the scenes that really strike me in Pulp Fiction and with Uma Thurman and John Travolta, their little story together is, I think, some of the best work Tarantino's ever done. Just, you know, taking place in that diner.
Jackrabbit Slims.
Yes. Yeah. Their dance together. And that whole thing is just perfection.
So it's innocence of the 50s. And then, like, at the end of that night, you remember the end of what that night was?
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Travolta throwing a hypodermic needle directly into her heart to, like, bring her back from the dead.
Yes.
So it's like, oh, the youthful 60s diner. And then you're like, no, she's a full on. Yeah,
yeah.
He had
yeah.
to bring her back from an overdose.
Right.
You know, so that's.
Yeah. But on rewatch, I must say the second half of Pulp Fiction lets it down a little bit. You're still talking about a classic film, but I think, you know, it gets a little choppy in the second half, and Tarantino decides to give himself a sizable cameo, which could have been a fatal flaw in my opinion, because he's not the best actor. Let's be totally honest. A great director and writer, but his acting skills leave something to be desired. So I'm going to actually say his best film is
his speech and talks too fast.
It's really
which
is
I kind of like now.
No, It is. He's talking too fast, and it's more like the tone deaf of the lines. Like it just. Exactly.
Yes. And then he like says the F word like without any feeling. You're like,
yeah.
That was the F word, but I didn't really feel like it was.
But then he like, so he starts off with this grumpy character, and then he completely turns around, and he's all like Mr. Nice to the Mr. Wolf character, or whatever. He's like, oh yes, Mr. Wolf, okay, Mr. Wolf, and that's like the rest. It's not.
I like watching him make coffee all right. for these guys while they're cleaning brains out of a car.
Ugh. So anyway, I'm gonna say his best film, though I once thought it was that. I'm actually gonna say Jackie Brown is his best work because I think that. His best work comes in his first three movies, in my opinion, because I think out of those three movies, you get the most depth and the nuance in those. And I think you also have some of the strongest moral centers in those first three, because like we said, there's definitely a shift towards this revenge narrative that happens for the rest of his work. So, and Jackie Brown is, I think, the best of his first three. And because you have this character in Jackie who... If I'm not mistaken, I think she's the only protagonist of Quentin Tarantino who does not kill someone at some point. She's not kind of a part of the scene, you know?
I haven't seen Jackie Brown in a year.
Okay.
And I've only seen it once or twice.
That's okay.
So I don't have...
No worries.
I don't have that down, so I can't really discuss it with you.
Sure.
But you were saying...
Yeah, so I'm just saying, like, so she feels the most pure out of the protagonist that Tarantino has, and she also teams up with this other really sweet character named, I don't know his name, but, like, he's a bail bondsman. And so together, they're basically outwitting the cops and also the criminals, and they do it with their minds instead of resorting to the violence. Violence that we see in the later work. So I think it has the most moral center, and it's also just his best evenly rounded
it's like the
film.
Hardy Boys.
The Hardy Boys. Well, I wouldn't go that far.
They're using their wit to outwit
right.
these criminals.
Exactly. Now, as far as favorite, because I do separate best with favorite, you know, like Schindler's List is, I think, one of the best films ever made, but I'm not going to watch that, you know, on a Friday night. So
popcorn.
Yeah.
You're
so...
Like, like, yeah, it's a little sobering, right?
A little bit, yeah. So my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie is, this is hard for me. I was debating all day between Inglourious Basterds or Kill Bill, because like you, I agree, there is definite power in Inglourious Basterds. And what I really like about that movie is the accents, how most of it takes place in his foreign language. It just feels like the most like elevated of his dialogues, like just with this, you know, German and mixed with, I don't know. I really like that, and it's an extremely entertaining film. However, I am going to give the edge to Kill Bill as one movie, Volume 1 and 2, because okay. it's just style coming out of its ears, and it's so fun. Uma Thurman is awesome in that, and it's just great characters. Bill is a great villain, and there's just so many elements in that. The constant switch from black and white to color and the sound and the music, it's like everything comes together for me in that movie, and it's such a great ride. So
I wish about I think it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that they had been released. I wish they'd been released as a single work. I know it's long.
Right. I know. And it was originally going to. He shot it that way, but they would not do it. A four-hour movie in the theaters, they just wouldn't do it. Right. So,
even if it was in 70 milliliters.
Well, it might now. This is what's great, is he has been promising for a decade to come back and release the Kill Bill, the whole bloody affair, he calls it, which is a completely cut-together film. He takes out some of the connector scenes, does an intermission. The Crazy 88 scene is in color, no black and white. And yeah. So he proves that all together. So maybe with this whole 70 millimeter that he has established, this is going to actually be a reality in the next couple of years. That'd be really cool. Yeah. So
we love revenge narratives.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they also make us ask the question, like, are we the sick ones? Because I feel mm-hmm. like Tarantino may not be advocating a revenge narrative. He might just be showing us one and we love it.
Hmm.
Which
well, and that's the question, I guess, that I come to with Quentin Tarantino, and we'll get to that in a minute, but like, is there a master plan like that, or does he just enjoy it as much as we do in the basest part of us? You know, that's the question.
A little both.
Yeah. All right. So before we get to that, so here we are at The Hateful Eight. This film, again, takes place in the Old West. It seems like a similar era to Django. This time, it is basically about these eight characters who find themselves in this room together during this blizzard. And we get to know them bit by bit, and we realize that none of them are what they seem, and there's a lot going on underneath the surface, and they end up facing off against one another, and yeah, that's basically The Hateful Eight.
John, you sent me an article about this, and mm-hmm. you basically said that Tarantino gets interviewed,
mm-hmm.
and it says that, like, he imagined, what if all the, that there was always an episode every year on, like, Bonanza, the old TV show,
mm-hmm.
which is a spaghetti western-y kind of show, and... Well, it's not spaghetti western because it's not Italian, but it's a western. And where all the villains, you don't know who the villain is, and they all get locked in a room. Like, that's just yeah. like one of their, they just went to it because it was entertaining and, oh, you know, who knows? It's a whodunit kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that that was like one of his desires. And, but what if everybody in the room was evil?
Which they definitely are, as you discover. Yes. They live up to their name. The Hateful Eight. I want to nail come to where we are. So what you've had a week and a half or so to have this settle in your mind. What are your thoughts on The Hateful Eight? Is it a good movie? Where do you think it fits in or ranks with the canon? Go.
I think it was a fun experience. It's really hard. Like when we saw us together, we got the best deal on a movie I've ever seen. We got free popcorn, and it was like $5.
It was $5. They have this special Tuesday movie night for $5, all shows, all day at our local theater. And so, yeah, for $5, we saw the special format.
Which was great.
Yeah.
But the experience was fantastic of actually going to the movie, the 70mm experience, the fans. You had people in there that who knows how far they drove to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew that this was something that they wouldn't be able to get again. It was a unique
only theater in our state. Yep.
Yeah. And so that actual experience of the film was great. As far as where it ranks with his films, I struggle because I find that I have to sit on them for a long time and then maybe rewatch them in a few months and get a sense of what I feel. I think I came out of this one kind of feeling like, yeah, it was probably a B.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I usually go on star system, maybe a 3.5 out of yep. 5.
That's fair. I think I was landing on around a B minus. So yeah, I'm with
you. Yeah. So I think it had all these elements that are a lot of fun to watch a film.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was particularly powerful, but I could be missing something because I think he is like a chess master.
Hmm.
I think he does. You know, I don't want to like go be too absurd, but like I think he is like, you know, like, it is like a Russian novel sometimes because you really need to think through it and you need to reread it. I mean, like rewatch it
mm-hmm.
and to get some of the stuff that I missed. So I'm going to feel a lot better making a determination on that probably in 6 months.
Fair enough. Good. I'm with you with the B-ish category. I do think if you were to look at his whole big picture, is probably his worst film. I agree with you. It probably need a few viewings to make the official determination, but it feels like it. Okay, so the movie's split up between these two halves, and it really is a movie of two halves. Mm-hmm. Because the first half, to me, is much more... is much better because you're basically getting to know these characters and you see this classic Tarantino just bit by bit revealing layers here and there, and then you have the intermission, and then you have the second half, which, like, from the beginning is just a total bloodbath. It feels, and I may be wrong about that, but it feels like his most violent hour of film. I don't know if it struck you that way too.
So you're saying it's like the Gospels.
The gospel.
First half, you get this character development, this great, great, hey, this is, you get back and forth banter, and then it's a bloodbath, right?
Hmm.
I'm not saying that that's where he was going.
Yeah.
But I would say, like, I probably agree with you on that. I'd say, yeah, it was kind of a bloodbath in the second half.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, expand on this a bit, the Gospels.
Well, I think we can talk more about it, but I think that the film spends a good 30 seconds, which really caught me off guard. The first 30 seconds is a close-up on a stone crucifixion.
That's right, yeah.
That's the first 30 seconds of the film.
It is. More than that, it feels like.
Maybe it's like 45 seconds. Yeah. It's a long intro,
mm-hmm.
And there's no dialogue. It's something mm-hmm. we're staring at Christ for mm-hmm. the first, 45 seconds. Now, yeah. You know, they say don't find a Christ figure everywhere you look, which I think is probably good advice. But if you see a Christ figure, maybe that's okay to call that a Christ figure. And then, I think one of the things I noticed is it's like, well, he died at, he basically was lynched.
Yeah.
And died this and died a gruesome, violent death.
Mm.
And artists throughout the ages have been obsessed with that. Like, you get the 16th century depictions of Christ, and they are hyper violent, or Mel Gibson's depiction of Christ.
Right.
Hyper violent.
Well, that is a really good point. We don't think about that as much, do we? I don't know how we've sanitized the cross so much, but there's no question about it. That it would have been horrific to behold.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, you look at some of these blogs that won't, like, some of the Christian, I'm not pointing at anybody in particular here, but you can find them. Some of these Christian things won't even review Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
They won't review him. In fact, I've seen reviews that are based on other reviews, which to me is, like, irresponsible.
Oh, no.
So because of the hyperviolence. Yet at the same time, we have a very violent story ourselves.
Mm.
And so we point the finger at Tarantino, but, I mean, I'm reading genocidal narratives that make Django look like nothing. In the Old Testament scriptures.
Hmm.
And so when we ask ourselves, when we point to Tarantino as, oh, he's this great evil, we got to look at also our story and say, do we have a violent story? And I say, yeah, we probably do.
That's a great point. It is. One thing I do wonder is kind of what we were talking about a little bit ago is how, to me, when you have these two halves, it's something that you kind of see throughout his entire filmography is there's these two sides of Tarantino that he sort of bobs in and out of on this dance. So to me, there's kind of this very artistic Tarantino, this, the 50-year-old version who's very, like, he's leading you on a journey, like he's showing you violence for a reason. There seems to be a point to it. We open up in The Hateful Eight with this image of the cross, and you're thinking, okay, is there a statement he's making? Is it like, this is what we've become as humans, God help us, etc.? And so you have that side of him. And then there's this other side that feels like kind of this 12-year-old Tarantino who it's like, wouldn't it be cool if that guy just blew his head off? And and it seems like he you see him walk this line throughout all of his films where sometimes he veers off a little bit more towards this, sometimes it's more towards the 12-year-old side. And I think, like, Hateful Eight is kind of like the two halves of Tarantino split literally into two halves. So you have that first half, which has that sort of artistic character development, this is all heading somewhere, don't worry, hang on. And then the second half, which is kind of like, it would be great if this happened, et cetera. And so it's like you wonder, is it which one is real? And you're right, it's probably both, isn't it?
Yeah. And why do we go to a Tarantino film?
Well,
it's like really the question. So I know there's my 16-year-old self is basically it's voyeuristic. It's almost pornography to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, ooh, I can sneak into this and see this guy get his head blown in. You know, mm-hmm. boom, mm-hmm. And see brains all over a car.
I'm like Pulp Fiction. That's what you're talking about.
Pulp Fiction. That's my. But I think that we maybe we lose the point. Like, you know, but that does exist. Mm-hmm. Like that exists, mm-hmm. and I'm not, and I don't think we can downplay that. This is not ever going to be a film that people are taking their kids to. Hopefully,
right.
And I would, you know, I wouldn't even probably recommend it to anybody.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing. You guys have to be honest about that. As a Christian, we have to deal with it. It's there, and it's not pleasant at all.
Mm-hmm. So then you ask the same question. Should I also not read the book of Joshua, right?
Right, right. Or Judges.
Ugh. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And so looking at those things, I think it's hard to kind of separate that. But I think it's part of who he is. Is you go in, you're going to see somebody's head explode. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. going to happen. And so, you know, is the question that you have to ask, is this worth this narrative?
Right. Exactly.
I think Christians have been doing that for a long time. We go, is this narrative worth this? And I don't know in this case with this movie, is mm-hmm. it worth it? Should I subject myself to some of this imagery mm-hmm. if I'm not even clear on what he's saying yet? Mm-hmm. Maybe later I'll know and I'll be like, yes, this is worthwhile. I felt that way about Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
Felt,
me too.
Oh, yeah. I was like, hey, I felt this is a worthwhile film. Exactly. I'd watch this again
yep.
and I'd recommend it.
This and that's one, what I mean about yeah. that line. Like, yeah. Yeah. Right.
So I think it's kind of, I think it's a little dangerous, but at the same time, yeah, it's like, is it worth it? Because I have friends that are very literary, who are into art, who are into film, that won't see Tarantino films mm-hmm. because to them, and they won't see other ones that have hyperviolence like David Lynch films, because of those things, and probably Kubrick could get lumped in there too.
Now, Lynch is a great point. I'm glad you brought him up because that's what I think of when I think of this idea. Because so Lynch, he you know is known for these very ambiguous movies with like just so a lot of random images popping up, and I always want there to be a point. Okay, it's like fine, confuse the heck out of me as long as there's a secret to uncode. You know, so when Tarantino, I always want to feel like I'm in good hands, and that's what scares me a little bit is when like you know when he comes on as the narrator in the second half and he kind of like is this little schoolboy just like I start to feel like maybe I'm not in good hands like you know that's what I don't know is there a someone you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think you're ever gonna feel comfy,
right?
And I think that's on purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is this visceral nature to those films that make them yeah, that way. But I would say, like, we look at some of these films, especially as Christians, and we wholesale endorse some of these films that are hyper-violent, but because it's a different style. It's not as stylized as Tarantino. Mm-hmm. So right. We would have no problem, like, being, yeah, no problem watching Saving Private Ryan, even though people are, like, eviscerated in that first scene multiple times, and there's heads flying around. And like
that's a good point.
I also think mm-hmm. of one that was, like, really, you know, it's probably controversial, but what is it? Is it American Sniper that Clint Eastwood directed?
Yeah, I did not like that one.
It's got narratives. It's an okay movie, but like looking at that, that's a hyper-violent movie also.
Yeah.
But it seems like, I don't know if this is Christianity or anybody, but if we can find some kind of narrative that kind of lets us overlook the violence, then the violence is okay.
Mm-hmm. But when it's violence just there, it's like all of a sudden it's horrific, even though from a tit for tat point of view, it could be the same exact amount. It's just the way, right.
Right. And so it's like, if it has the right narrative around mm-hmm. it, we can accept tons of violence. So.
Or in the Bible, of course.
Or in the Bible, but like even like Schindler's List, like you said, mm-hmm. that's one of your favorite films.
Yeah.
It's like, that's one of the most violent films I've ever seen.
Absolutely. It is.
But it has a narrative that surrounds it that...
comforts us.
Well, I think it has resolution. Mm-hmm. It's not... it is realistic violence. Like it's realism.
Yeah.
Like these things happen. And it's not over the top.
So when you're looking at thematically Hateful Eight, the rest of Tarantino's film, so when I look back on it, we talked about the revenge narrative. That's what it seems like is the most predominant theme is wicked people getting what they deserve, often at the hands of, you know, maybe who Tarantino would consider a righteous person, as in like someone who deserves to be unleashing that vengeance. So the Jew who is wronged when their family is massacred in Inglourious Basterds, or the bride whose whole wedding party is destroyed, she now has the that's righteous vengeance, you know, yeah. And the bad guys get what they deserve. However, I know for a fact that you were once working on a essay entitled Grace in the Works of Quentin Tarantino. This intrigues me. I've never completely heard your take on this. Where do you see grace in the works of Quentin Tarantino, Tim?
Well, I think within the revenge narrative, you're there's a lot of places that you see these grace. We talked the other day about Pulp Fiction, and
yes,
we talked about the motorcycle being named Grace,
which is very interesting, and I did not notice it until this most recent viewing. So I've got to tell you this. So like that scene that comes before that whole Bruce Willis Ving Rhames rape scene, I think is just so detestable. I like hate that scene so much. Yes. I feel like it crosses a line for me. Like Pulp Fiction is like I should probably be more horrified by what happens earlier than that, but that scene is where I go really, like really.
That's and like then straight out of the David Lynch playbook.
Oh, and then right after that, Bruce Willis comes out of there, and yes, he gets on a motorcycle, and blazoned across the motorcycle is grace. And right after that is when Samuel L. Jackson begins this narrative towards, like, kind of waking up and like, what am I doing with my life? And heading on the, quote, path towards righteousness, as he ends up quoting a Bible verse later on. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, so that's, like, that's pretty... Yeah, it's worked into the plot in places in that movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the theme, but I think within Inglourious Basterds, there's the opening scene where they're speaking in French, German, and English. Mm. But they you can watch the subtitles carefully, and you'll notice sometimes the merci is actually mercy. Like it's weird. Rewatch it. I can't remember the specific thing, but the idea is like they don't translate.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That'd be awesome.
But those are just like little. He does those kind of things. Like he does these little tricks. But I really think like he's saying, is there another way? Because he's showing us these this brutality, and then we fully embrace it. So within like we talked about earlier in the podcast, he's this Nazi Holocaust. He has the viewers fully on board for it. Like we're all about burning these guys to death.
Mm-hmm.
And when that theater catches on fire. People were cheering, and that's for him that was great, and then when I look at Django, right? We think Django's great. He's a lovable character. Let's be honest. But then when he goes back for revenge. He starts shooting everybody, and then he shoots some people that didn't do anything, and you begin to go. And this is, I think, part of Tarantino's kind of deal is we're used to these Tom Hanks righteous characters that either right or wrong, or they're put in a situation where they have to do something that they wouldn't normally do. But I think what Tarantino offers us instead are characters that are kind of a little of everything, so that, which might be more realistic. Mm. So if you look, I've been reading through Genesis in January, and I'm looking at these characters that seem at some moments they're like incredibly righteous, and these other moments they're murderers. Yeah. And so I think that you have that same thing that's going on with some of these films. So yeah, even with the Jamie Foxx character in that film, he's willing to like basically kill people at far distance,
It really bothered me. Like, the end of Django was upsetting to me because I feel like it's almost like a perfect movie up until that point, and then he comes back, and the music kicks on, and it's like, I didn't want his character to go there. Like, I just wanted him to ride off in the sunset with his wife and happily ever after, but no, it's like you have that moment, and but you're right. And especially with biblical characters, I mean, we want to put everything into a nice, tidy box, but...
Oh. I would say they're definitely not nihilistic. So I look at, like...
Hateful Eight could be.
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I look at stuff that's like, is it Coen Brothers that did No Country for Old Men?
Yes.
Like, that to me is like a clearly nihilistic kind of film. Like, that's the most offensive film I've seen in a long time.
Hmm.
I've seen all kinds of films. But like to me, that was like pure nihilism. And I don't get that out of Tarantino. Out of Tarantino, I see that he is giving us something that actually probably looks more like reality than what we are. What settles well with us, with our narratives that we have inside of us.
Hmm.
Because what we want is a character that never does evil,
yep.
that gets wronged, and then he goes and does the right thing in the right way and makes evil go away.
Yeah.
And very often, like, that's not reality. Reality might be more like The Hateful Eight and how that resolves. I don't want to spoil anything.
Mm-hmm.
But... that might be more reality. And that might actually be closer to our narrative in scripture, too.
Hmm.
So we might be angry because it challenges our story, not because it's a bad story.
God kind of makes us uncomfortable sometimes, too, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Like, we want kind of a cute, cuddly God who's our buddy, but, like, he's dropping people dead at times, and we don't understand that.
Yeah. And then why? Because there's characters, and I'm, within that are innocent. And why did the innocent characters, like, if this was the story that we'd want to see, that we'd have people ride in and save the innocent characters, but we don't see that. The innocent character, and it's without pageantry, and so I think that, like, Tarantino might actually be closer to how things, not the actual acts of violence, but that there would be this mixture of good and evil.
All right, so now here's an interesting thing. You were talking to me briefly before we started about how that you see actually in The Hateful Eight that Tarantino is pulling from some older films here, which I definitely did not pick up on. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it. I don't know everything because, like I said, he is like the T.S. Eliot of alluding to films from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm looking at it, I do know I identified some pretty major ones. Why did he pick his composer? Well, because that's the composer that, Sergio Leone uses in all the spaghetti Westerns, which is he's an Italian director that's making Westerns. So a lot of people are familiar with it because that's the Clint Eastwood character.
Oh, in a fistful, down, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah that's okay. Him. So it's a fistful of dollars, a few dollars more in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's a trilogy there. Mm-hmm. And so we're all pretty familiar with that, or at least we kind of know of it. And so that's like spaghetti Westerns, and they're spaghetti because it's Italian people that are making Westerns, which is a weird idea. So what's interesting to me is one of the spaghetti Westerns is like Magnificent Seven. So as we look at Hateful Eight, it's a direct like allusion to Magnificent Seven.
Ah.
And so just looking at that, like we're like drawn into this idea of he's paying homage to these other Westerns. I also see like a lot of the Kurosawa, because like Samurai is it's Magnificent Seven is based on Seven Samurai by Kurosawa. And there was a day, folks, and some of you all are old enough to remember this, when on Netflix you could watch all these movies for free. Well, for $8 a month. They're gone now. But when they were there, I would binge watch those, and they were free. Now you got to like order them online for $27 each.
The library.
So, right. It's not going to happen for a lot of us, so we just have to hopefully get there. But, you know, a lot of this stuff is drawn directly from these other things. And so he's paying homage to these different filmmakers, which I think is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. We talked about format already. But, yeah, it's just interesting to see that direction he goes. And I think of Samuel L. Jackson's character, like in The Seven Samurai, I was talking to you about this earlier, he produces this letter from Abe Lincoln, right? Not in Seven Samurai, but in the movie. He produces it so he can be a credible guy.
Because to white people, basically.
To like, white people.
Right, right.
And within Seven Samurai, you have samurai who are like a certain level on social status level.
Okay.
And then you have villagers who are like basically the lowest of the low. So they would be like the African-American, like in the film, or the slave in the film. And we have one of these seven of the Seven Samurai, the last one, to become one of the samurai, to join these other samurai. He has to produce this letter that says he is a samurai. And in reality, it's not his letter. It's from someone else who's actually... It's a fault. We find out that it's not really his.
Really? That's in The Seven Samurai?
That's in The Seven Samurai.
Okay.
And so, like, that's a direct allusion. The Abe Lincoln letter is, like, this direct allusion to Seven Samurai. My opinion.
Yeah. Well, we thought it was, like, maybe this whole thing is a microcosm of America, but...
Right, but it's still dealing with, like... Even with Kurosawa, you're dealing with, like, this idea that... you're dealing with class distinctions. You're dealing with racism. You're dealing with, economic discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So peasants versus samurai versus feudal lords. And I think that you look at... I think that is with a theme within... We talked about themes. I think you do have race. You have gender.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes out in this film like crazy, right?
Oh, yeah, it does. You do have all these distinctions, right? So you have the aristocratic type, the British guy versus the criminal versus et cetera. So yeah, it is there, definitely.
Yeah. So I think like he is paying homage to these spaghetti Westerns. He is using the same composer that Leone used for all these things.
Who won a Golden Globe for best score.
Really?
He did. Yeah, and Tarantino actually accepted the award on his behalf and said that this is the first time he's won an American award for a movie. So that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I think like when we watch him, he's begging us, Tarantino's begging us to go watch other movies. And so I'd say like go watch Yojimbo. Like Fistful of Dollars is based on that. Okay, so go watch it. I mean, if you can, if you have access to it, go watch it. If you, if you've got access to, you know, Rashomon is not being referenced here, but that's a great Kurosawa movie. And so, like, and especially like with Star Wars, we entered with The Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the characters of C-3PO and R2-D2 are based on a Kurosawa film called The Hidden Fortress. There's two characters in there.
Seriously?
Yeah, Lucas bases them on.
I need to brush up on my Kurosawa, my friend.
Yeah.
I'm lacking.
So, like, to me, like, one of the powerful things about the film is it's asking us to go back.
Mm-hmm.
It's not saying, like, I've, like, we're Pulp Fiction's, like, I got this whole new thing that's changed. This is changing film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's changing film. This is saying film was really, really good. And if you trace, like, the lineage of this film, you're going to find that there's a whole lot of other great films that you don't even know. And I, that's what I found, you know, I was like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I'd heard about these folks, you know, from people that were like film snobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and watch them and it's just pretty, pretty, pretty worthwhile. So, you know, even the Leone films are pretty worthwhile. So, yeah.
Well, I think that that's going to do it, man. That's great talk on the works of Quentin Tarantino. Thank you so much for participating. I appreciate it. And so 8 films, we don't know what's next, but we do know that he's promised to only make 10 movies. I don't know if he'll actually follow through with that or whether he's bluffing. But, yeah, who knows?
Was it like 9 volumes for the last one?
Right?
Yeah.
Well, who's that? Kevin Smith has promised to retire like, you know, 20 times, and he's still good. Making movies.
Yeah. Clerks is probably his best, but yeah.
So I apologize to anyone who is actually looking forward to a Revenant podcast. We are getting there. We will, a review of the Revenant will be up soon. I'm very excited to see it. I haven't seen it. Have you seen the Revenant yet?
I haven't yet, but okay. it's been getting pretty decent reviews.
Has been. And it won a Golden Globe for Best Drama Picture.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
Yeah, which was really surprising, and it throws the Oscar race into complete disarray. Speaking of which, Oscar nominations are announced tomorrow morning.
Oh, they are?
Oh, yes. Get up early, put it on your calendar.
I don't know.
7:30, my friend.
So I'll leisurely check my Yahoo or whatever.
Well, will The Hateful Eight be nominated for Best Picture? Honestly, at this point, I have no idea because it's been such a weird award season. I don't know if you watch the Golden Globes, but like, I have no idea what's going on. Matt Damon walks away with a win for The Martian, like the most generic performance of his category. He shouldn't have even been nominated, and somehow he beats Christian Bale from The Big Short, who is just stunning. So I don't know anymore. We'll see.
It's a strange year.
Yeah, it is.
It's a strange year.
For sure. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. And Tim, always love talking film with you. Let's do it again next month.
Right.
And yeah, thanks again for listening, everyone. And yeah, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.